This is Story Behind the Music, and I'm Darren Story. This program is my way of paying homage to some of the great music of our time, R&B and soul music. Now, since I'm a product of this era, I'm compelled to make sure that the impact of R&B and soul music is never, ever forgotten. Each show, I'll delve into the music, the artists, and the origins of the rich history of R&B and soul music, and along the way, get the stories from those who made it happen. I'm Darren Story, and this is Story Behind the Music.
I don't know really how to start except by trying to explain to people exactly what they're going to be listening to as we go on this journey, this excursion in music. And it really is something that I thought about not long ago, the idea to do this show, because since I am in the music industry myself, I am a member of the group Low Key, R&B group from the 90s. We were on A&M Records back in the day, had a number one hit called I Gotta Thank You, had some other nominal hits as well. But very rarely do you get an opportunity to do a show where you're talking shop with people like you, and you get a chance to ask questions that you normally don't get asked, Susie. And I think that real music lovers, especially this genre of music, and because the genre is so, what's a good way of saying it? It's so diminished now in today.
Right.
It's great for us to be able to remember what it used to be like when guys and gals were going in the studio and really working to make a record, and you know, spending hours and weeks and months in these studios creating these masterpieces. And then also the opportunity to unearth hidden gems or songs that we liked, but it's like, has anybody ever heard this? You know, I mean, and that's what you're so good at. And if you don't know about DJ Susie Chase, you can catch her on thegrooveradio.com. She does an amazing podcast every week of just straight, like, wow, I haven't heard that in a long time, or straight, like, I've never heard that before, and that's dope. You know,
she does. I play everything you love and you've never heard.
Exactly. And I don't know if that's an oxymoron or not, but we'll go with it. But really, that's what this show is all about. So we'll be playing a lot of music, Susie, and Susie will be, you know, helping us through that because she has a vast array of music, and I have my own, you know, library or whatever of songs that I think are cool that maybe you haven't heard or nobody else thinks is cool. And then we'll also take the opportunity to talk with some of the individuals that were part of the, shall we say, the landscape of R&B music. And I'm thinking, you know, we'll probably delve more late 60s, 70s, 80s, early 90s, and that's kind of going to be our playground for the most part. And so we're just gonna have some fun and revel in the, you know, reminisce and just have a good time, you know, with music. And we all hear things like music is a universal language. But I think R&B music and soul music just needs more love. And I'm a product of that era. And I know you are, Susie, as well. So we're just going to, you know, every week do our best to pay homage to some of the great music that you've heard or some of the great music that you've never heard.
Well, and it's timeless, too. It sounds great today.
It does. It does. And, henceforth, sampling. Okay.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, for the last 20 some odd years, sampling is still happening. I thought sampling was going to kind of be a fad.
Yeah.
But it's not.
After Puffy.
Yeah, it's still going on. I mean, people are still sampling. And, you know, and God bless samplers, because it's making money for a lot of these songwriters and artists that, you know, thought maybe their stuff was over, and now it's not. So, I mean.
Well, we hope it's making money for them.
Well, we hope it's making money if they're doing the right thing. I have a sampling story, but we don't have time for that. But
thank you.
Thank you. you're welcome. So anyway, on our first show tonight, Susie, I had the opportunity to talk to an individual that is one of the, he was a member of a group that we looked up to. And if you remember the group Switch, I know that people, when you hear the word the name Switch, they immediately think of Bobby DeBarge,
mm-hmm.
or DeBarge, the name DeBarge. And absolutely, totally get that. You know, he was a bigger than life individual in the group. He sang most of the songs. He was the prettiest guy in the group and all of that.
You hear all the women going, "Ah."
Yeah, you know, and he was a grown man and he came a long way. So, but what a lot of people don't know is that the founder of the group was named Greg Williams, or is named Greg Williams. And Greg was the trumpet player. You may remember him if you go back and look at your album covers. He was the darkest brother in the group, and wore the hat, you know, the fedora, and wore the scarves. You know, that's what the scarves around his neck. That was always cool. But Greg actually founded the group, put the group together. And we had the opportunity to spend some time with Greg and did an amazing, I don't even want to call it an interview, it was a conversation caught on, re-recorded. It was a beautiful thing. And so we're going to share that with you. And this is going to be an example of what you hear on our podcast.
Well, I think my favorite thing about this interview, and I think that the listeners will find so interesting, is your connection with Greg as a fellow artist.
Yes. Yes. And I think that's really the important fiber, if you will, or the fabric of this show, is that when I'm talking to these people, we've traveled down the same road. It may, you know, some of the scenery might be different, but the road is the same. It's paved with the same materials. So let's just use asphalt. We've all traveled down the same asphalt road. Or if you're from down south, it's a dirt road or gravel or whatever. And we've seen the same things. We've had some of the same experiences. And that was evident in my conversation with Greg. You know, our relationships with your band members breaking up, band members who you struggle with. Obviously, he talks about Bobby's addiction to heroin and having to deal with that and keep the band together, which it's hard to do. It's hard to keep bands together anyway, even if you have no problems.
Right.
Let alone having your lead vocalist, everything that you built the group around, struggling with a heroin addiction. So, but one of the things that I loved about Greg is that he's kind of like count it all joy. He wouldn't change a thing.
Yeah.
He wouldn't change a thing about his experience with the group, how it came to be, how it started, when it stopped. He just was grateful.
He was so positive throughout everything.
Absolutely. He was so grateful for the opportunity. And so that, for me, you know, inspired me. It really did inspire me. As you know, as Susie, as you know, and just for people out there listening, you know, my group Low Key, we're about to make a reentry into the business. And so talking to him actually kind of pumped me up and had me looking towards a future with some optimism and excitement. And that was something that I wasn't even planning on getting out of the interview, was something for me. And that's always cool when you can get something out of it, besides the fact that it was just an amazing conversation. And I really hope that everyone out there enjoys it.
I think they will.
I'm going to take your word for it. Because DJ Susie Chase, she's here to do one thing and one thing only. Make things sound good. That's what she does.
Further ado,
let's go to the interview with Gregory Williams, founder, leader of Switch. This is Story Behind the Music. Story Behind the Music, I'm Darren Story. It is my esteemed pleasure to have a gentleman that I grew up listening to. Not that he's that much older than me, don't get me wrong. I mean, but he is part of one of the legendary R&B groups, probably a group that has not really gotten its just due. It's probably one of the more underrated R&B groups, one of the more talented R&B groups. He was with a group called Switch on Motown back in the day, and he's one of the original members. Greg Williams is here with us, and Greg, welcome to Story Behind the Music. How are you?
I am great, Darren. Thank you. Thanks for having me again.
Well, as we were saying before the interview started, I let the people out there listen. I told you that I was feeling a bit verklempt because I'm a little starstruck, because you are one of the
groups that myself and most of my cohorts in our band back in the day grew up watching. I remember your record came out in 78, the first Switch record. Now, you have some history. We'll talk about that before Switch. But the Switch record, obviously, with They'll Never Be and how that just took R&B radio by storm. And let me ask you this, because I know from my own personal journey in the music business, is when you put a record out, we felt like our song, I Got a Thing for You, we felt like it was going to be a hit. If all the stars aligned, if the record company did their job, we felt like it was a great song. When you guys put out They'll Never Be, was there a feeling in the band that same thing, if everything goes right, if the record company does their job, this is a hit record? Did you guys feel that way about that song?
Do you know something? Honestly, we were just a humble group. I speak pretty much for the overall, being the founder leader of the group and the guy who handpicked each individual in Switch. Mm-hmm. We had similar personalities and similar likes and had the same vision. So I can, in many situations, speak for them yesterday and today. Okay. And the thing is that we were just some humble cats, man. We just wanted to play, you know? I came out to L.A., wound up getting the deal. You know, there's a whole story behind that. If you want to get into that, we'll get into some of that. But anyway, came out here to L.A. and wound up getting a deal. And everybody followed suit. Fortunately, the deal afforded everybody to get out here. We got out here. We just continued to rehearse, began cutting stuff with Jermaine and a few other Motown people. And we just kept doing what we do musically. We were just so happy living our lives. Man, it wasn't an expectation of success and stardom. We were humble. I mean, we knew we had kind of fell into something great when we signed with Motown and had Jermaine working with us. But the anticipation of hit records, yeah, of course, somewhere in there. You know, and then when we presented They'll Never Be, Bobby and I, when we presented They'll Never Be to Barry Gordy late one night, about 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, he called and we, you know, played it for him. You know, we knew then when he said it was going to be a hit, we knew it was going to be a hit because he was going to make it a hit no matter what. Yeah, but we could not have imagined, and we talked about it many times thereafter, we could not have imagined how big it would become and the impact. Now, having never had a hit record before, we didn't know how it felt.
Yeah.
So we didn't really know what to expect.
It's a great feeling,
but
though.
Boy, did we exceed any expectations. Excuse me.
It's a great feeling, though, isn't it?
God. Even today, though, to be honest with you.
I know, absolutely.
Even today.
I feel the same way. It doesn't really matter. It doesn't get old. When you got a hit, and all of a sudden, I know with me, sometimes I'll be around the house here, and all of a sudden, I'll have on a music choice channel or something on my television or Pandora or something like that, and then there's our song. And I'm like, wow.
Uh-huh.
I mean, like, people still care so much that they're programming and all this stuff. And we get a lot of, and I know this happens for you, people just showing love after all those years. And going back to what you were saying, Greg, about how you guys were you just wanted to play. And I think that's when we came along was the early 90s. You guys came along in the late 70s. And I think that's a real case study in how the industry had changed or how people like us, when we got into the industry, it was about driving for hits. And so we were already thinking that way. Even though we loved the music, we loved to play, but we were already thinking like, we need a hit, man. If we don't get a hit, we're going to be out in our streets. You guys were still humble and still thinking about, let's just make good music. And is that kind of the mindset of the group, that if we just make good music, everything else will take care of itself?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And fortunately, it wound up being true in our case. And fortunately, too, we had power in our support system. I mean, because what gets better than Barry Gordy, if he believes in you?
Not too many things.
You know? Okay? So with that in mind, that being the driving force behind it, we knew that we were in good hands no matter what we did.
Absolutely.
And Barry expressed enough personal one-on-one interest and time in us where we knew even if we did, our record did not do what they expected it to do and all the things they told us it would do, that Barry would hang in there with us. And sure enough, you know, we didn't have to count on that because he made sure that first record was a hit.
Absolutely. We're on with
And from that point on, it was on.
Yeah. We're on with Greg Williams of Switch. He is the founder, put the whole thing together. Let's go back to the White Heat days, Greg. And
okay.
So tell us about that. It was kind of Barry White's deal. It was. It looks like it was. It was. You know. Even let's go back even further. First Class. Let's go back there to the Midwest.
Oh God. Okay.
Let's talk about First
Class. Okay. Wait a minute. First Class is post White Heat. White Heat was where it all really began.
So White Heat. So White started with White Heat. Okay. And tell us about that project. What was that supposed to be? And you guys were under the auspices of the maestro. That guy. I met Barry once, and he was just. And I don't mean this to be facetious. He is larger than life.
Truly.
I mean, he is truly large. Not only is he a large man, and I tell people all the time, I said Barry White is not like this big fat guy. He is just a big man. Nicest man. I mean, warm and everything, but he's larger than life. He fills up a room in more ways than one, his presence. And so working with that guy, I mean, that had to have been amazing.
It was, man. It was one of the most incredible hits. And little 19-year-old Greg Williams in a band with 13 members. And when I joined the band, they were already together. They were called TNT Flashers. And the trumpet player quit, the keyboard player quit, and the percussionist. They had left the band, and the band had a tentative deal with Barry White already because their manager and Barry were best friends, and he owed Barry. Barry owed the guy, so he promised him once he did his production company, he'd sign the act. Well, the guys got tired of waiting. They're stuck in Phoenix, Arizona for months, and nothing happened, and they got tired of waiting. They quickly went home, the three guys. So I was called as the trumpet to fill in for the trumpet player, and I told them I would come if I could bring Bobby. I took Bobby with me everywhere, Bobby Barch. So I took him with me, and I mean, fortunately, they said, yeah, okay, we don't have a keyboard player either. Bring him. You know, and so we went out and hung out in Phoenix until Barry called us 3 months later. Now, meeting Barry White was a hell of a thing. You know, late one night, we'd get into L.A. after driving from Phoenix. We have 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. Barry comes, meets us with Bermuda shorts on and ashy knees.
Ashy knees.
And ashy knees, big Barry White. With
oh, man. Take a lot of lotion to hook up those knees, I bet. Oh. Wow. Okay, so Barry's got ashy knees.
Yeah, but we signed the contract that night.
Wow.
What it was a 63-page, some big contract for 7 years with Barry. Wow. You know, to do 7 albums with him on his production deal on RCA Records. You know, I spent time around Barry personally because I was like the little study guy, the little geek that wanted to learn every darn thing. Sure. So I spent a lot of time when I could, you know. Around him learning. He was a great guy. He was a nice guy. He was a matter of fact about a lot of things, you know. And when he cursed, he roared, so it was intimidating to everybody around. But bottom line, he was a great guy. He was a hell of a person to, you know, to be around when he was in his creative zone, because magic flew all through the room. There was like sparks from a gang of sparklers. You know, Barry was something special. And you called it a project, and you're absolutely right. It was a 7-record deal, but it wound up being one project because after the first record came and went without a whimper, I think we got back more copies than they pressed up. And with that in mind, that deal was over. It was about from 19... we signed in 74, I think, and it was over in 76 with the one record.
I read something that this is totally, you know, because if you believe everything that you read on the internet, you know, I mean, you're an idiot. But there was a blurb saying that he dropped you guys for a tax write-off, and I mean, well, that's just standard fare in the record industry, anyway. So,
well, you know, something. The truth of the matter, too, real quick on that one, that came from this German guy who's been trying to take claim to various aspects of Switch, and I don't know if you're familiar with that thing. He's got the roots of Switch and DeBarge and all that.
Yeah, I read a little bit about that. Yeah, what's his deal?
Well, that came from him, you know, that kind of bluntness. I mean, that was him trying to make a point so that he can get you know, folks to believe in and pay attention.
Yeah.
There's truth in it, to be honest with you, but he didn't drop us as a tax write-off. We were the tax write-off from the beginning, the production company, the whole production company. So there was about six of us that wound up out in the cold when that company came and went.
Yeah, I know. That's,
you know, Solo Unlimited Productions was the name of it.
Absolutely ridiculous. Well, I mean,
yeah.
that has to be, but, you know, regardless of what happened and how it ended, to have spent time with Barry White and learning from him, who Barry White, again, is, I think, underappreciated throughout the history of music and his contribution. And because everything he heard in his head was a symphony, even though it was an R&B song. And how he fused orchestration with R&B and soul music, to me, has always just been genius. And I think I can, and as I think about some of you guys' records, your records, some of that happened. You know, when I listen to your records and I hear string arrangements and horn arrangements of you guys' records, I hear it. I hear that influence. You know, I hear that time that you spent just, you know, probably being in the same room with him and watching him work. I hear that, Greg. Would you agree with that?
I absolutely agree with it. And the funny thing about it is nobody else refers to that. But, if someone has, you're one of the first or in a small group. No one else refers to that. And I swear by it. I was heavily influenced by Barry in my orchestrations and my horns. And I started as a horn player. So I was, you know, into what he was doing. And I did bring some of that to Switch. There's some things that the public has never heard that are more Barry White. And that's probably why Barry Gordy said, okay, Greg, we'll put that on the back burner for now. You know, but yeah, I was heavily influenced, and so was Bobby. You know, I don't think anybody else got it. The only ones that were under Bobby, under Barry, were in that Barry White deal were Bobby, Jody Sims, and myself. Tommy DeBarge came after the fact.
That's a great segue, Greg, because I want to talk about a little bit about the relationship between you and Bobby DeBarge. And I want this conversation because I know we spent a lot of time and I've seen I've seen the Unsung episode and I think a lot of people spend time talking about the tragedy of Bobby DeBarge and I know that's out of love because people I think we all wish he was still here contributing.
Yeah.
We wish he was still here singing because his voice was unmistakable and an amazing songwriter, producer, but you knew him more than that, and so I want to spend some time talking about the man that you knew, you know, the smile that you saw, the laughs that you had, the time that you guys spent creating together. Let's talk about you and Bobby DeBarge and your relationship.
Okay. First and foremost, Bobby DeBarge, he's incomparable in my life. Mm-hmm. He really is. I love him from day one. I love him to this day. You know, we became friends when I was 15, and we became brothers, you know, shortly, in a very short span of time. I'm talking about days, weeks at most, you know, because we had commonalities. You know, we had vast differences in upbringing, but we had commonalities, you know, beginning with the music and the other things that came out of that. And there was a side to me, there was an ambitious side to me on accompanied with my musical talents, you know, and with Bobby, there was the talent side, and he was kind of withdrawn. So we kind of yin and yang the whole thing through for a lot of years.
Right.
And I knew I had to look out for him. I mean, and the contributions, you know, a lot of times the contributions between the two of us were equal because there were a lot of secrets, a lot of things that we confided in each other, a lot of laughter, as you said, you know, because he was silly. He's just straight up silly when he wanted to be. When he wasn't plagued by, you know, the negative aspects of life, he was a fool. And we just had, you know, we grew up together. See, like you said that about band members, you know, sometimes having, you know, more impact on you than your family. Yeah, we grew up together.
Yeah.
So even more so than my brother Art, who I love dearly, who was with me, you know, through a lot of this stuff. But me and Bobby wound up being a lot closer. So with that being said, you know, we got to learn the inner workings of each other, what made each other tick creatively and otherwise, you know, and it was just a special bond. And we fought like cats and dogs, too, sometimes.
Of course.
I can remember a few times wanting to kill him, wanting to put a contract on him. So. and vice versa.
Absolutely.
You know? But for the most part, you know, I mean, we were together. I mean, there was also a period where we were absent from each other for a few years. He went to prison, mm-hmm. you know, and that was a separation, and of course, of it. But then thereafter, too, he came back, and he came back, and he had AIDS, and he mm-hmm. was, you know, on short terms, and we all knew it, and he drew closer to me again. And actually, what a lot of people don't know is Bobby lived with me until for about the last year of his life. He spent 8 months with me until the last 6 weeks of his life where he had to go in the hospice. So they came, the brothers came, and they flew him back to Grand Rapids, and,
wow.
you know, that's where he lived. Wow. There's a whole lot to Bobby's in my story, and I don't know any specifics, but if you've got specific questions, I don't, you know, I can
well,
answer.
Well, just let me ask you this. Let me ask you this about him. Just do we have any idea of just how talented he was?
No. No, absolutely not.
I mean, have we even
absolutely
scratched
not.
The surface? Is there enough out there? Is there enough out there on Bobby DeBarge that we've even scratched the surface on his talent?
Honestly, no. Honestly, no. This guy, I mean, a lot of people, you know, I mean, the name Switch came from various, all of us being able to play various instruments, all of us being able to sing. But people don't know that Bobby could write a song on the wall. He could start tapping the wall with his fingers, and everything would come out from the drums, beginning with the drum sounds and the percussion sounds, and get all the way to the strings and the horns and the vocals and 13 background parts and things like that. Bobby could be riding in the car and wake up out of his sleep and have a whole song done.
Wow.
You know, I mean, no, there's no way that he had a chance to get one out of who he really was creatively. Mm. You know, and of course, Motown decided to exploit what they found to be profit-bearing
right.
at that time. But he was really ahead of his time.
Yeah,
you know, there was so much other stuff in him that, you know, that never had a chance. Had he lived longer, you know, even on his deathbed, even at his worst, he was still creating songs.
Wow. Wow.
He was. That was the one, that was the one tangible thing. That was the one solid thing. Everything in his life seemed to flip and flitter because of various reasons, things in his upbringing where his whole life was thrown off balance, where there was no normality for him. So with that in mind, music was the only solid thing. That was the only real thing that he could claim he is. His heart was broken a few times because of his relationships, but music never, that girl never let him down.
Wow. We're on with Greg Williams, founder and leader of the group Switch, one of, in my opinion, R&B music's most underrated groups and probably most talented group, man to man. I mean, just by a man, you guys had a lot of talent in a small space, but you seem to manage it very well. I want to talk to you a little bit, Greg, about the influence that Switch had on the culture of R&B music. I mean, you guys were some good looking guys. All right, so I'm not saying that I'm a man. I'm very much straight, but you guys came out and, you know, especially when you think about Bobby and Thomas, you know, dark skinned brothers had to like really change, you know, and we had to fight for ourselves because, you know, the light skinned brothers and, you know, that dynamic is in our race, you know, where the girls is like and wanted to date guys that look like Bobby DeBarge, you know, and Thomas
mm-hmm.
DeBarge and all that. And he was everybody's favorite. But you guys really kind of glammed up groups. You know, I mean, before, you know, you talking about the funk bands, and it was kind of this rugged look, you know, and groups like Brass Construction or Sun or, you know, Cameo wasn't really glamour. It's just, you know, some guys in some glittery uniforms, Earth, Wind, and Fire, you know, they had. But you
yep.
guys were like the first, like, real pretty boys, if you will. With style, was that intentional or that just something that happened?
Nope, absolutely. And I, you know, I take credit without vanity on that one. I had a vision. I honestly had a vision sitting on my mom's steps in Grand Rapids, Michigan, with just transitioning from White Heat, where the group broke up when we got dropped and everybody left but me. you know, and I sat in the house that we had been in trying to recreate, and it started coming to me. But then after I had to go leave Ohio and go back to Michigan for a minute, I sat on my mom's steps and I said, okay, Greg, now how do you get where you want to go this time?
Right.
And I really did, man. I sat down there and I had a little pad and I wrote it out. And I said, okay, I'm going to be a producer. So, okay, what's going to get you there the quickest? And I thought of a group. And I said, let me come with a group of handsome guys. You know, they got to look good. I can be the only black one in the group, so I ain't got no competition.
Because there's still some sisters that are going to like you, too. I mean, so that's really
okay,
good.
Yeah, well, yeah, I had my group now. Come on now. And there was no, I had no competition, so I wasn't worried about that. Okay.
You're very strategic,
everybody had
Brad.
To be able to sing. Everybody had to be able to play more than one instrument. You know, and everybody had to kind of have the same vision and respect my role as a leader because I had something that I was going to run. Fortunately, it all came together. What a lot of people do not know is, okay, now this is where that group First Class comes in. First Class was a group that I had, my original group that I pulled together at that point. I got a budget. That German guy that I was telling you about, he fortunately, now that was his role in this to help me get that initial budget to get this group off the ground.
Sure.
Then after that, everything else is made up. But anyway, I got the budget. I pulled the group together, and I had everybody but Bobby, our members of that group, First Class. That's who we named First Class. Bobby was brought into the group after I had the deal with Motown. The guy that I had playing keyboards and singing in that upper register refused to come.
Wow.
I got everybody here in L.A. I mean, you know, Motown's making the deal. They've given me bus tickets for everybody. And come on, let's do this, guys. And everybody else was willing to come. And this guy said he couldn't come. He had just gotten married a few months earlier. And he wanted to be with the family life. He really didn't believe in it after White Heat. He didn't believe in it. So anyway, that's when I had no choice but to get Bobby. And understand this, and if you recall, I said it on Unsung. I love Bobby. I wanted Bobby, but Bobby had too many damn problems.
Right.
Not to mention the biggie, which is he was strung out on heroin at the time. Yeah. But, you know, I stepped beside my thought because I know how incredible he is. And I'm just hoping, okay, maybe I can help him be strong enough. We've been best friends all our lives. Maybe I can help him be strong enough.
Was that the feeling?
You know, and I had a talk with the group and told them what was up, and we brought Bobby in. So, and then we became Switch.
So, Greg, was that the feeling that if you got Bobby into Switch, which was looking like a very stable situation, let's face it, you know, you got the Gordies behind you, you got Jermaine Jackson about to come in and produce you guys. Did you feel like this could be the thing that helped Bobby turn the corner?
I did, and I prayed it was. You know, but then as soon as Bobby got there, I realized who Bobby was. And you know, all the bad things in his life he could not let go of. He couldn't get past a lot of the things that happened to him as a kid, you know, that created the confusion and the self-destruct pattern. He couldn't get past it. And then I finally just told the guys in the group, and this was before we even started working on our record. I told the guys in the group, this is not going to last long, so let's just ride it for what it's worth.
Wow, you were
and
prophetic,
I knew it
huh?
Because Bobby was on self-destruct, and I knew it from the very beginning, but I had no choice, you know. I really had no choice. It was either lose the deal with Motown and start from the ground up,
so let me
or
ask
do this and make it happen.
So let me ask you this, Greg. Knowing everything that you know now, going through everything that you've gone through, would you have done the same thing?
Absolutely.
I like that.
And I dare say this, without Bobby DeBarge, I very seriously doubt that Switch would have impacted the world the way it did. You know, I got to give credit where credit was due. Plus, another thing is this. I am not a devout religious man. I am a Christian. I do believe in God.
Sure.
But I know for a fact that this was God's doing. This was not Greg's doing. Mm-hmm. I sit here and told you just a moment ago about my plan and my vision and all of that. Well, you know, that was planted inside of me, and it was driven, and it was executed by the hand of God only.
Absolutely.
Meeting Jermaine Jackson in an elevator 7 days after getting to L.A. with no real contacts and nothing else, and one tape.
Yeah, that doesn't happen to most people. That doesn't happen.
Man, this was God's doing. It was just unreal. All of it was unreal. And I kind of just went with the flow because I had to. And it was meant for Bobby to be a part of this. Yes, I would do it all over again.
Wow.
And not just because I loved him, because I wanted him to have that opportunity with me. Me and him had dreamed of that opportunity forever. Since we met.
There's nothing better than that, Greg. There's nothing better than to be with your boy. And you, because the same thing with the guys I still play with now, being in the basement, talking about the future. There's nothing
when I make it.
When we make it, here's what we're going to do. There's nothing better than having those conversations day in and day out, night in and night out, in the basement, sitting around, talking about when we make it. Those are the best conversations. And when you finally get the opportunity to have that happen, you can't envision doing it without them. I know
absolutely.
That feeling. I know that feeling.
Yep, absolutely.
I want to segue, and we're on with Greg Williams, leader and founder of Switch, Story Behind the Music. I want to say, because you're doing a great job, teeing it up for me. Jermaine Jackson. Now, I contend, first of all, there's two things about Jermaine Jackson that people don't know. Three. One, he doesn't get enough credit for the songwriter he is. Two, he doesn't get enough credit for the producer he is. And three, I was 4 feet from him playing bass once, and nobody knows how this dude can thump a bass. All right. So tell me if I'm wrong about any of those three things.
Nope, you are absolutely right about those. And funny thing about it is those are well-kept secrets. It's almost tragic.
It is tragic. I mean, has anybody read a liner note lately? I mean, and understand the impact and the contribution he made to you guys? I mean, it's really like blasphemy. I'm just being a Jermaine Jackson fan. I mean, I'm like, wow. I mean, and like I said, when I heard him play bass, because he came to Kansas City, and this is when, 84, 85, Greg, he came to Kansas City and did a concert, and this is what I was doing. I was actually a security guard in front of the stage, because we hadn't made it yet. We still, got a job,
That's good.
Job during the day and then you playing at night, but I had a night off and I was working at Worlds of Fun. You guys played there too, here in Kansas City. And, you guys used to come to Kansas City all the time. We loved y'all. I think you should know that. Kansas City loves some Switch. And so I seen you guys a couple of times with one of those mega bills where it was you and Gap Band and Slave and, a real concert.
Yep.
Barcades
and Cameo and all of the.
Yeah, that tour, you guys were touring. I mean, so you guys came back to Kansas City all the time. We loved Switch. But I was right in front of the stage doing crowd control, and Jermaine went into this bass solo on Let's Get Serious. And I had to turn around and look at this dude, and I'm like, is this dude playing bass? I mean, I'm thinking, Jermaine plays bass. Yeah, I mean, I'm sure Jermaine. No, he killed. He killed. And I was like, if I had text messaging and cell phone back then, I would be text messaging the whole band saying, Jermaine Jackson is absolutely putting this bass on fire. And so you worked with him, so you saw him all the time. I mean, you knew how talented this guy was. He was working with you. He was giving you the game. I think people need to know, Greg, and since you're such a humble guy and you're always giving people credit, and right now with Jermaine Jackson, and I'm going to shut up in a minute because I think people kind of think he's, with the whole Michael Jackson thing and the Jacksons and all the whole family thing and those dynamics, put that all aside. Jermaine Jackson is an amazing musician, songwriter, producer. Tell us about it.
Absolutely. Well, and it's a long story here. I'll do my best to keep this thing short. Bear in mind, Switch signed with Motown through Jermaine. Met Jermaine on February 9th, 1977, in an elevator, Jermaine and Hazel. Okay, the next day we spent with Jermaine. If we have time, we'll get into that whole story. But anyway, the next day we spent with Jermaine. Now, keep in mind, it's 1977. 1976, Jermaine stayed with Motown when his brothers left.
Mm-hmm.
There was a big void in his life. And here comes five guys who he took a liking to immediately, six guys who he took a liking to immediately based on me and Jody. And so we kind of filled the void of his brothers. We wouldn't know, we weren't his brothers, and there's no way in heck, but we spent a lot of time together. We had a house. The group Switch had a house. Jermaine would come over just to spend time and play with us during the day.
Wow.
You know, we knew he was incredible. Him and Tommy, you know, the one they would swap off and play bass and then sit up and watch each other. But Tommy would give it to Jermaine, and Tommy would watch him. Jermaine would give it back to Tommy, and Tommy would he would watch Tommy. You know, but Jermaine was awesome on that bass. He was incredible. And then a lot of people don't know how much he taught us as well about the business and about production more so than anything else.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
You know, how solid records were made. You know, but we actually, we really wish we could have made him a part of Switch. But that was Jermaine Jackson. And, you know, but he spent as much time with us wanting to be a part of Switch. We were tight, man. We formed, he, Michael McGlory, and myself had a writer's pack. There's a lot of songs that the three of us wrote together. Mm. And you know, some on his Frontier album, one on his Let's Get Serious album, and some that other artists have done.
Awesome.
This brother is incredible. He always had it. Something that a lot of you guys don't know either, though, and this was a Motown thing. I'm not going to beat Jermaine up too much about it because that's my brother and I love him dearly. I'm the co-writer of I Want to Be Closer.
That's my
and
jam.
The thing of it is
that's
that
my jam.
There were some credit differences.
That's my jam. That's my favorite Switch song of all time.
Thank you. Well, Jermaine and I wrote that song.
Really?
Even though it's credited completely to Jermaine, Jermaine and I wrote that song. And I guess at some point in time, we'll get that straight. He and I have even had a big dispute about it, but, you know, not so much so that we couldn't get past it.
Well, good. And I hope y'all get that straightened out, man, because that's...
Oh, man, that's my brother, you know, okay? And brothers fight, okay?
Right.
You know, and Motown has a lot to do with that. It'll never be right, but, you know, as long as it's corrected somewhere, it's cool. No trip. But getting back to the question you asked me, this guy is a phenomenal guy. He's just underrated, undercredited. You know, living in the shadow of a Michael Jackson was not an easy thing to do, but, God, what a shadow to live in.
I think Jermaine is kind of like the musician's musician. Of course, we know, but others, the general public, are more concerned about pop culture and, you know, image. But that's why I think he's overshadowed, because he really wasn't about that. He was about doing the music, and that was all he wanted to do. And, you know, it's
absolutely, for the most part, that was it, too, really.
That's a shame, but that's okay. That's okay, because we know, and the people that listen to this podcast, they'll know, and hopefully it'll make them delve into, well, maybe I need to Google Jermaine Jackson and see exactly what he's done and listen to some of the things that he's done. And that's what one of the things that I hope this program does, Greg, is to invoke people to go deeper. Into and get beyond the surface and go deeper and find out that there's so many incredible musicians and singers and producers, and get the real story about how it goes and the things that you went through. And then, like I said, we've talked a lot about the relationships that you guys had with people. I have to say, Greg, you know, you guys don't have the same drama as some of these other groups have had. I mean, other than obviously the untimely death of Bobby and some of the issues that you had to deal with that, but it sounds to me that you guys were relatively functional. Would you say that's
the truth? You want to hear the crazy thing, too? Philip, Eddie, Michael McGlory, and I'll explain Michael a little more here in a second, but those guys are still right at my side. We talk sometimes two or three times a week. I'm doing some major stuff with Atlantic Records and Warner Brothers right now, and I just called Philip yesterday to come in and join me and do some things with him. But we are close. We are brothers. We did not have the conflicts that many other bands had, you know, and we still work together now. Now, we're still close. I talked to Tommy last week, you know, and I talked to Jody. It's probably been about 6 weeks since I talked to Jody. But these are my brothers. We grew up together. I'm never going to let anything come between us. And remember, I said this when I handpicked guys. I picked guys with similar likenesses, similar visions.
Yeah.
And with that in mind, we can still get along with each other. Yeah, you butt heads every now and then, but those are my brothers. And when I call, they come.
Well, without
and vice versa.
Absolutely. And without conflict, there's no consensus. Because that's how you get to
exactly.
You know, if everybody's just saying, yeah, yeah, let's do that, eventually it's going to blow up.
And, you know, I quote this all the time because my dad said it in a simple way. He said, boy, if you got two people that agree all the time, one of them's useless.
Amen to that.
I love that.
All right, so let's move forward. According to what I've been reading in my research, you guys are still, like the guys you mentioned, still working together. What's next on horizon for Greg Williams, for Switch, for your career in general, Greg? Tell everyone out there what you're doing.
Right now, okay, my company is Switch Entertainment, LLC, and it's been a management consulting press and publicity company for years. And the press and publicity came in like after SwitchCon, after I stepped away from Switch in 1985, I wound up my dearest friend in life, Cynthia Horner, who's the editor of Right On, who was the editor of Right On magazine for 28 years. Now she's the editor of Hip Hop Weekly right now, mm-hmm. and editor at large for Word Up magazine. So she's still doing her thing. She's still my dearest friend, and she put me in a position when Right On decided that it was going to do an offshoot. She made me the editor of the new magazine. So with all of that, doing press and publicity and all the different things through my company over the years, it's still moving ahead. Right now, I am in alliance with a company called Curve Entertainment. And Curve Entertainment and its owner, Kevin Irving, you know, worked years with Dr. Dre producing acts like Truth Hurts and Eminem and some of Dre's records and The Game and a lot of people that come through that camp. But besides being hip-hop, he discovered and brought Bruno Mars to the table. Well, he is also A&R for Atlantic Records in a couple other situations. So I'm working with him. My company and his company are working together to bring forth some new talent. We've got 17-year-old African-American girl, 19-year-old African-American guy, a la Michael Jackson, who's the bomb, 20-year-old Korean girl, who is sings like Christina Aguilera, and we've got other acts that we're developing now, and that's what I just brought Philip into to do some vocal arrangements and some other stuff for some of these projects. So, but that's Greg Williams, and I'm growing and still doing my thing there. But Switch, we are touring from time to time. We take on dates, you know, these old school festivals and things like that when we get them.
Awesome.
You know, in fact, I was going to mention to you, you missed us in Kansas City about 3 years ago. Switch, Lenny Williams, and
I did miss you, but I heard about the concert, and I can say this on the internet. I was pissed that I missed the show because I had not seen Switch since 1981, and that was one of those concerts. I think it was you guys, the Barkay, Slave, Gab Band. It was like six groups, and you guys, and so you guys did Municipal Auditorium back in 1981 here in Kansas City, and it was an amazing show. And I will tell everybody out there that they can sing all the stuff they sing on their record.
I used to think about immature things. You know, like, do you love me? Do you want me? Are you gonna call me like you said you would? Is this really your real phone number? But you know, I'm a man now, baby, a grown man. And I came a long way. And experience taught me one thing. Taught me to hold on to my love.
Yes, that was Greg's favorite song, according to him. I Call Your Name by Switch, of course, from the album Switch 2.
That's your favorite song, too, isn't it?
Actually, I Want to Be Closer is my favorite Switch song.
Oh.
It is. That is because I've always loved when Philip and Bobby sang together or sang in the same song, because their voices were so different than, I mean, you couldn't get it really get much different than Bobby DeBarge and Philip Ingram. So that's my, because that song is like, to me, the red light special, you know, that's the slow jam. That's the, you know, that's the stone jam. Yeah. You know, so it just make your voice get deep. So that's what it does. I don't know. I mean, or when you're like, you know, 13, your voice is not really that deep, but you want it to be. You're thinking about it. And it's the house party red light song. I Want to Be Closer. So anyway, we want to thank Greg Williams for being on with us. That was an amazing interview, Susie. I mean, I know you were listening, and it was just, he was so open, so honest. So
he was incredible.
I like to think that everyone that comes on the show going forward would be that gracious and that open. That is my hope, of course, but
yeah,
you never know. But he definitely set the bar high.
Well, it's always great when you don't want the interview to end. I just wanted to keep listening.
Yeah, and I wanted to keep going.
Yeah.
And we started talking even after, of course, you know, we talked a little bit after, you know, before and after the interview. But, yeah, it just was, I could have talked to that guy all night. I just, because he just knew. We were in this, like, I think I may have said this in the interview, that we were in the same frat. You know, we're in the same fraternity. So we have a kinship that no one can take away. You know, we might have been doing it at different points in our life, different decades or whatever, but the experience that we share is very similar. And we travel some of the same roads. Let me ask you, what was one of the things that was most profound that you heard him talk about? I'm just curious about what you thought.
I think that how they started out, you asked him why they started the band, mm-hmm. and then when they got really famous, why they kept going. And he said from day one, they just wanted to play music, mm-hmm. whether it sold, whether it didn't sell. They just wanted to get together in the living room and make music. And yeah. I think that's the magic of that band.
Yeah.
What do you think?
Well, that too, and I totally get that, because I think if you ask most musicians, they would do it for free. I mean, if you get them right there and corner them and say, you know, if you really love this, when you really love something,
that's love,
you'll do it for free. You really don't want it. It doesn't matter. And I think that Greg's group, Switch, that's how they approached it. You know, we're happy that we have a deal. We're happy mm-hmm. that we happen to have Jermaine Jackson producing us. We're happy that we're on like one of the greatest record labels in the history of the world.
Right.
But really all they wanted to do was play their music. And that's the organic truth. And I think that nowadays, when you look at the music industry, I think that most people want to do it because they want to be a star.
Yeah, it's lost. They just want to make money and be on...
Absolutely.
TV.
It's about, you know, endorsement deals, reality TV shows. And I'm not saying that to hate on any of that. I'm just saying that people's motives, or as it would say in the good book, as you know, you have a very old family Bible over there where you are, that where your treasure is, so your heart will be. And I think most people, their treasure is not necessarily in the music. Their treasure is in everything that comes along with the music and their stardom. So that was just a delightful conversation. And I think that's something that I want to stay away from using the word interview, Susie.
Okay.
Let's try it right now. Yeah, we're not going to say that word. It's removed from the lexicon of this show.
Okay.
Yes. And we're going to have conversations with people. And that was a fabulous conversation that I had with Greg Williams. And I want to thank him once again for giving us so much time. Because he's a busy guy, as you heard. I mean, he's got a lot of stuff going on. He is busy. You know, don't sleep on Switch. They are still doing it. And that's really good to hear. And that's the other thing about music that I love as we wrap up. And we're going to get to next part of our program where it's Chase's choice. She's going to play a song, a Switch song that she likes. And I have no creative authority over this.
It's good.
She promises it's good. Or you guys can email her or whatever and blog and comment and say, what was that song you played? You know, that was crazy. So, but don't sleep on Switch. And he's got a lot of stuff going on. And Greg is a behind the scenes guy. So he's not real flashy. He doesn't really care about everybody knowing what he's doing. But that's for people like us to talk about what he's doing. He doesn't want to talk about it, but we'll definitely be keeping you in touch. And I love the fact that he talked about, we're going to get the whole group on at some point.
Yes, I'm so excited.
We're going to get the whole group on. So that's going to be outstanding to get the whole group and get all of their perspectives. Right. Because really, we don't really know Jody and Eddie and Philip. We don't really know them. People don't really know them. We don't know those guys. And so it'll be interesting to actually hear those guys speak.
Yeah.
I mean, I would just wonder what they sound like. We don't know anything about them. So that's going to be fun too. And Greg's, he was just delightful. So that's all I got to say about that. It is now time for Chase's choice. It's a Stone Jam, she promises. What is it?
It's All I Need Is You by Switch.
All right, this is All I Need Is You by Switch. You're listening to Story Behind the Music.
Oh,
Thank you for joining us. You've been listening to Story Behind the Music. Story Behind the Music is a production of Intrepid Entertainment. You can find us on the web at storybehindthemusic.net, also on Facebook and Twitter at StoryBTM. We hope you join us next time for our next Story Behind the Music. Take care. Bye-bye.